Good day, and welcome to the 14th session of Inside the Beltway Conference, presented by Drinker Biddle. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. As you know from the past sessions, I'm the chair of the Drinker Biddle Law Firm's Financial Services ERISA team, which means that in addition to representing plan sponsors with their retirement plan issues, we also represent service providers, financial service companies that provide products, services, and investments to plans. And that's it's all under the umbrella of ERISA, but it's a different perspective on the issues. With me and my co-speaker is Brad Campbell. While I'm in Los Angeles, Brad is in Washington, D.C., so we've got you surrounded. Brad is a former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which means that Brad held the position that Phyllis Borzi now has, but under the George W. Bush administration. Both Brad and I are active participants in the 401k and retirement plan marketplace, and we're going to bring our observations to you about what's going on inside the Beltway. This presentation will be recorded. It is being recorded. And in a few days, it'll be available on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com, as you might expect, under a tab called Resources. You don't even have to remember that, though, because we will send everybody who registered for the program will be getting an email with a link to the recording once it's available. So you should get it by at the latest, let's say Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. In any event, so it'll be there for you or for your compatriots who you may want to have listen to this. At this point, I'd like to point out that Natixis has been really great for us. They're sponsoring these calls so that they can be brought to you on a regular basis. They are largely responsible for you having access to this information, and I want to give them full credit for that. So let me just turn it over for a minute to Bill Slumbaugh, who's Vice President of Retirement Strategies at Natixis. Bill?
Great. Thank you, Fred, and good afternoon on the East Coast. Good morning elsewhere. Once again, I'm Bill Slumbaugh, part of the Retirement Strategies team here at Natixis, and welcome and thank you for joining us today. For those of you familiar with Natixis, you know that our unique structure is comprised of 20 asset management affiliate partners, including some of the biggest names in retirement wealth management like Luma Sales and the Oakmark Funds, and also included our less familiar but equally impressive firms like Von Nelson, Alpha Simplex Group, and Gateway Funds. In addition to our world-class asset management, Natixis brings to our advisor clients what I feel is a very robust suite of non-product offerings to help you expand your knowledge base and ultimately to retain and grow assets in retirement plans. One example is our Portfolio Research and Consulting Group, and this industry-leading team of professionals has been helping our advisor clients to construct more durable investment portfolios, which are giving their clients better outcomes through these volatile markets and ultimately improving their financial lives. And if you're not familiar with our Portfolio Research and Consulting Group, I'd highly encourage you to reach out to your Natixis counterparts and learn more about that service. Also included in our non-product offerings is a very valued relationship with Drinker Biddle. In Washington, it's no surprise, remains a place of heavy interest and equally heavy confusion. And we're lucky to be able to bring to you who I feel are the leading experts in legislation and potential legislation that's ultimately going to affect what we do every day and how we help our clients. And without further delay, I'll turn this back over to Fred and Brad, and then I'll come back at the end to close the call. Fred?
Hey, Bill. Thank you very much. Everybody, let's jump right into the deep end of the pool. The biggest issue on the table for 2015 and 2016 is the DOL's fiduciary proposal, where it is, what it's going to say, how it's going to impact people. Most recently, Congress has been getting involved in the picture, and Brad Campbell has been part of that. So, Brad, you just testified before Congress about the fiduciary proposal. Can you bring us up to speed with what's going on in Congress, what the different types of proposals are, maybe even an assessment of what the odds are that Congress might do something before this becomes a final rule?
Well, yeah, Fred, I'll be happy to do that, although I'm not sure I'll go so far as to assign a probability to congressional action. Trying to predict Congress is something that is pretty much difficult for anyone to achieve with any degree of success. And again, thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to us here again this quarter. We certainly appreciate it. This is actually a really unusual and exciting time right now in that we've talked for a while about would Congress have a role beyond sort of the oversight and the hearings that they've held. And there's actually several different things moving in Congress that are all coalescing around the omnibus appropriations bill that's being debated right now. For those of you who don't specialize in Washington budget speak, what that means is you may recall a month or so back Congress came to a big picture budget deal where they extended the debt limit and put in place the caps that they're going to spend to for the next year or two. What the bill they're debating right now is actually how they're going to spend up to the caps. And so this is kind of the big must-pass legislation. If they don't do something by tomorrow night, the government shuts down, although it's likely that they, if they don't have a deal, will pass a short-term extension to give themselves another, several days or a week or so to work on it. But the reason this matters for the fiduciary proposal is that there's several different groups within Congress who are concerned with where this rule is heading, how fast it's moving, what's in it, and they're looking at this bill as an opportunity to let Congress put some changes into the legislation, or into the regulation, more accurately. So there are several different options that Congress is looking at. One group would like to defund the initiative to say to the Department of Labor that they just can't spend any money for 2016 on this rule. That probably is less likely than some of the other alternatives to potentially be included in this rule. And again, the reason they want to try and include it into this omnibus bill is this is viewed as must-pass legislation. The idea is that if Congress comes to a bipartisan agreement on this, that the president would sign it, and that therefore if there is a legislative rider, as they call it, on the fiduciary rule in this omnibus bill, that it probably would become law and not be something the president would veto the entire package over. So one option is to defund it. Another option is to require the department to repropose the rule with a short comment period, maybe 30 days. Sometime here next year, which would certainly affect the timing of the regulation and would give us an opportunity to see what it is the department's thinking, how it's going to resolve some of the questions that were raised, well, the many extensive questions that were raised throughout the comment period. another option is for, and this is something that our understanding is legislators are working on very closely, there's a bipartisan group with Mr. Roskam, Mr. Neal, Mr. Rowe, and some other members of Congress have come up with bipartisan principles to guide guide the rule. And are developing legislation that actually embodies those principles. And that legislation may be ready in time to be considered as part of this omnibus as well. So we've got a lot of congressional interest and activity at the moment. One other thing that just came out here today is that the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Oversight Committee in the Senate sent a letter to the appropriators pointing out concerns they have about the documents that they've been trying to get from the agencies to show how DOL came up with these rules. And in a letter that they just sent over to the appropriators dated December 9th, they're saying that the Department of Labor disregarded numerous concerns raised by the career nonpartisan professional experts at the SEC and at OIRA, which is a division of the White House, as well as from officials at the Treasury Department. And they're saying that the proposal doesn't reflect the feedback they got from some of those, which I think would be consistent with some of the criticism that was levied that, for example, the disclosures conflicted with securities laws and so forth. They're also concerned the department, actually they allege, was pressuring the SEC to not disclose documents that the department hasn't disclosed to the committee, and so they call on the Appropriations Committee to address this by trying to prohibit the Labor Department from implementing the fiduciary rule. So that gives you a flavor of some of the debates that are going on in Congress. So what does all that mean? Well, what it means is that we have a credible chance of seeing legislation passed that would either affect the content or the timing. and possibly both, of this fiduciary rule. I don't want to oversell this. I mean, Congress is never done until it's done. And as I said at the beginning, you know, if you were going to, you might have better odds in Vegas, you know, picking a random number than you might predicting where Congress is going to come out. But it's an exciting time in terms of seeing potential actual change in the course of this rule. And so that's kind of where we are in the short term. We'll probably know within the next 2 to 10 days whether Congress will succeed in changing something about how DOL proceeds and what that is. If, for example, they do a re-proposal requirement with, say, a 30-day comment period, that would actually require the department not just to show its hand so that the first time we see their solution wouldn't be in the final rule, but it would also alter their time frame somewhat significantly, because the effect would be more than just the 30-day delay. It would also be at least a couple of months for the department to respond to all those new comments and take that into account. So that's a long-winded way of saying stay tuned, because we might see a material change in the progress of this rule here in the next week.
Brad, I think I'm a little more pessimistic about the possibility of legislation. I think my concern is if the fiduciary rule were the only major issue in America today that the Republicans are concerned about, then I think I'd go along with it having a better chance. But my view is that the Republicans will probably try to attach a rider to defund Planned Parenthood, a rider to repeal or substantially cut back on the Affordable Care Act, a rider to limit Syrian refugees, and on and on and on. So by the time this gets over to the Senate, it's going to look like a Christmas tree all lit up with riders. And then I think the Senate will filibuster it, or if it gets to the president's desk, the president will veto it. And if I look at the politics of today, I think some of those issues are greater hot buttons than the fiduciary rule is. And so I think that the fiduciary rule will go down before they go down. And, you know, I just look at all of that, and it just looks like a terrible mess to me, and I can't imagine the president not vetoing a bill that had all that kind of stuff in it. So,
well, I think you're right to point out that this is a big-picture bill that goes well beyond the issue we're talking about today, and there is the potential for almost anything to happen in terms of what other stuff might be added to it and whether that would incur a presidential veto. That's why I was careful to say I'm not going to assign a probability to it, because it's hard to predict.
Yeah.
But they're going to have to fund the government one way or the other, so the question is what do they add to it and how much do they rein themselves in to get something the president will sign, and that's what the negotiations going on right now are about. I think the fiduciary rule has a better chance of sticking in than some of those real hot button issues, and I don't see it being one that's traded very easily. I mean, I don't see the Democrats won't say, okay, fine, if you include the fiduciary rule, we'll go along with defunding Planned Parenthood. So, you know, in the horse trading, this probably is one that doesn't get traded for something else. So I'm a little more optimistic than you, but I agree. This is by no means a done deal and something we're going to have to just watch and see what happens.
Yeah, and I think didn't Hillary Clinton just come out and endorse the fiduciary proposal and encourage the veto of any bill?
Yeah, she did an op-ed calling on the Senate and other members of the Congress to not weaken or water down the rule. So there's definitely a lot of politics to play even on this issue. And I think you're also right to point that the Senate is probably the real sticking point in terms of what can be done and what could be added to this process.
Yeah.
So probably that's a good way to round it up and just say, hey, we got to wait and see. But there's a fight going on, which is a change compared to, you know, sort of months of congressional discussion, but no concrete action.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. These are really interesting times. Boy, the bullets are flying. Well, with that in mind, and let's assume now, Brad, that there isn't a legislative delay. What do you think the timeline is for the fiduciary proposal and the exemptions right now? In other words, what's your best guess in terms of when we're going to get it, when we're actually going to see some final exemptions and final regulation, and when do you think it's going to apply to people?
Yeah, so this assuming Congress doesn't change the timeline or the content, and we're proceeding on the administration and the Department of Labor's timeline. You know, it was interesting. The government just released the updated regulatory agenda right before Thanksgiving, And on it, they didn't actually give us a new deadline for when they were going to put out the final rule. They noted that in December they would still be working on it, in essence, but didn't say when they expected to publish the rule. You know, we've heard Secretary Perez say it would be in the first half of 2016. There's been rumors that maybe it would be as early as January, and I personally don't see that being possible. I just don't think the department can consider the just sheer volume of issues that have been raised and deal with those and address the comments in that short a time frame. My personal best guess is that they're still operating on an idea of getting this out maybe as a final rule in March or April, somewhere in the spring, which would then, if you take the 8 months proposed delay in the effective date that was in the proposal, would get us with a regulation that goes into effect at the end of 2016, but before the end of the Obama administration. And that would make sense because if the rule's already gone into effect, it's going to be much harder for the next administration to make changes to it that are material, and it also will presumably reduce some of the demand to do so because we will have already spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars and made efforts to comply. So I think that's their goal, is to get it out in the spring and go into effect by the end of the year. But, you know, that's also an ambitious agenda item. I mean, there's just a lot of work for the department to do to have a final rule that's ready to go.
Yeah, Brad, I think the way that works, if using your timeline, let's say publishing it on April 30th, that would mean they'd have to get it over to the Office of Management and Budget like in February or March, right? And then we would know that it had gone over there, that it was final. We just wouldn't be able to see it yet.
Yeah, we know when a rule has been formally referred to the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House, for review. And that review under the executive order is up to 90 days. And in most regulations, it's 89 or 90 days or longer when they extend the review period. In this rule, we saw the proposal that came out here in April of this year was at the OMB for less than 90 days, about half of that time. And I would expect that given the significance of this, the interest by the White House and by senior staff there, that I wouldn't be at all surprised that it was at OMB for a much shorter period of time than is normal. Again, maybe, you know, maybe half of that 90 days or less. So I don't think we can count on the normal, you know, once we see it has been referred, that it'll be 3 months till we see it. I think it'll be sooner than that.
Okay, well, so much for the moment, at least, for politics and for process. Let's get down to substance. You know, from an advisor's perspective, there are essentially three rules here we're dealing with. One is the fiduciary definition regulation. Another is the 84-24 exemption for most insurance products. And the third is the best interest contract exemption, also known as BICE or BIC, for the most highly regulated products like bank accounts, collective trusts, mutual funds, stock exchanges, and so on. Let's break those into their component parts, Brad, and start off with the fiduciary regulation. What, do you see any big changes there? What do you think is most likely to change that might be meaningful in the big picture?
Well, you know, I think going as far back as the DOL administrative hearings in August, DOL was already kind of making some noises that maybe they could do some changes to the education provisions. They had narrowed the education provisions by, you know, not allowing you to reference particular investments in connection with giving participants something like a model asset allocation chart or pie chart. And so we've kind of heard from the department that, well, maybe they could still allow that to just be education and not be advice as long as you provided all of the available investments that matched up to each asset class rather than picking some, which would, you know, picking a representative sample, which would give you the appearance of advice. So that's probably something that wouldn't be too surprising to see. You know, another issue that's been raised is this notion of when a wholesaler, you know, somebody who's representing a product manufacturer, when they go and talk to a financial professional, someone who's a, you know, an advisor to plans, the way they technically wrote the rule, if that advisor is a fiduciary advisor to the plan, which certainly under the effect of this rule they all essentially would be, then that could make the wholesaler a fiduciary as well, giving advice to the third-party financial professional. And it doesn't appear that DOL intended that, and in conversations there, it's been suggested that probably they'll look to clarify that so that wholesaling activity isn't advice. But it does sound like there's some issues they're a little concerned about there, maybe cases where the wholesaler is actually talking to the plan or in the room with the advisor in the plan. So it's not as clean as them saying, no, we didn't intend that and we won't do it, but we would probably see some changes there. Some of the other big questions outstanding on the rule itself, the big one obviously is, will there be a broader seller's exemption? Right now the general rule only permits that for large plans with 100 participants or 100 million or more. DOL certainly didn't seem very receptive to expanding that in the hearings, the administrative hearings. But there have been a lot of questions raised about why 100 participants, why is a large plan of that size more sophisticated than a small, why are all individual IRAs treated the same, shouldn't there be something like an accredited investor approach taken there? Those are areas where DOL might make changes, but it's hard to predict. I mean, our biggest problem is we're going to have as we go through these other issues, you know, just Fred and I talking, is you know, we're all speculating because there's very little the department has said publicly. They're working behind closed doors to develop a final rule, and most of these issues we probably won't see what they're going to do until we see the final rule we have to live with. So there's some things where we can try and read the tea leaves, but we also haven't really seen yet the department kind of quietly floating ideas, which I think will come, but we haven't really seen much of that yet.
You know, Brad, you mentioned the you know, investment education for participants and maybe going back to something more similar to Interpretive Bulletin 96-1 where you could actually have models or pie charts. My sense is that's probably for retirement plans. People have also urged that that same concept be extended, that is the 96-1 concept, be extended to IRAs. But I sort of get the feeling that the Department of Labor is saying, hey, wait a second. For retirement plans, the 20 or 30 mutual funds have been prudently selected and monitored by fiduciaries, so we're willing to allow some flexibility there. But for IRAs, where it's a maybe 2,000 mutual funds on a platform, we probably won't allow somebody to create a pie chart of that or an asset allocation model and say, here, that's not advice. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. In general, the kind of sense we've gotten from conversations and hearing what other people have heard from the department and so forth is that when it comes to the plan space, they're probably going to be a little more willing to offer some accommodations on the various comments because, as you say, there's a fiduciary standing there. Whereas part of the whole reason they're doing this on the IRA side is because they argue there is no fiduciary and therefore there needs to be extra protection. This is where I'll get on my soapbox and again remind the department that when Congress passed ERISA in 74 and created IRAs, Congress affirmatively decided not to put a fiduciary in the middle of the IRA relationship. So I would argue that that's that their argument that there's no fiduciary, therefore we need extra protection, in fact a fiduciary standard is not what Congress intended. But I'll get off my soapbox on that again and just say I think the result will be in the rule that DOL will not be very accommodating for a lot of the IRA issues, but will be more accommodating for the plan issues.
Okay, good. One last thing, Brad, on this, and then we'll move on. But just to put the nail in the coffin, it strikes me that it's almost certain that the DOL is going to maintain its position that a recommendation to take a distribution from a plan or a distribution from an IRA is a fiduciary recommendation. It makes the advisor a fiduciary if they make that recommendation, and then there could be prohibited transactions if they make more money that way than if the participant had left his money in the plan. Do you agree? Do you think that's pretty much baked into the cake at this point?
I do. I mean, I think that realistically is one of the core reasons they're doing the proposal the way they did this time around. I mean, one of the big contrasts to 2010 is that I think the 2015 version is really much more about IRAs, frankly, than it is about plans. And they're very concerned that at the point of rollover is where all, as they would perceive it, all the good work the department and ERISA does to protect people potentially is eliminated or is, you know, harmed. And so I agree with you. I think they're going to stick to the notion that rollover advice is fiduciary. And that creates, as you said, a bunch of prohibited transaction issues because a retail product typically is more expensive than an institutional one. So you end up with these cost differences that result in prohibited transactions. That's why I think the real action in a lot of the regulation here is going to be how they change the best interest contract exemption, which is presumably the cure for those prohibited transactions.
You know, I couldn't agree more, Brad. I think it is about IRAs, and I think the key is the best interest contract exemption. But, hey, before we go there, let's talk just quickly. Let's get the 8424 out of the way first. And for those listening in that may not be familiar with all the lingo we're using, prohibited transaction class exemption 84-24 as modified, as proposed to be modified, would require or would apply to all sales of insurance products, annuities, life insurance, whatever, insurance products, to retirement plans, to participant accounts, or to individual retirement accounts or annuities, except for the sale of individual variable annuities to IRAs. In other words, you could get the protection of the exemption for everything except for the sale of individual variable annuities to IRAs because the Department of Labor said it followed the Securities and Exchange Commission's approach, which is to treat individual variable annuities as securities and not as insurance products. Therefore, individual variable annuities sold to IRAs are moved over to the best interest contract exemption, which almost regardless of whatever the changes are, it's going to be more difficult to comply with. Having said that, though, so let's take that off the table and go back to 84-24 and talk about the sale of insurance products generally to plans and to IRAs. Brad, any thoughts on what changes we might see there or important things that you don't think are going to change?
Yeah, one of the things people are wondering about is would the department try to go beyond that distinction it drew about which annuity products, for example, are securities and which aren't, and would it try to move the fixed indexed annuities over to the best interest contract exemption? The proposal left them in 84-24. If I were going to make a prediction, I think they probably stay in 84-24 because I think moving them over. It wasn't what the department proposed. I don't know that there was really a huge amount of comments on calling for moving them over that would really cause them to want to incur the potential, allegations that could be raised that they didn't follow the process properly in making that kind of change. So I think it might well stay, and they might stick with their existing rationale. But I think probably the bigger issues in 84-24 are the changes they make to the definition of commission. And what's included, more importantly, what's not included in how they revised that, and the effect that'll have on different types of compensation that providers are currently receiving, bonuses and recognition awards and all those sorts of things, which have become controversial in other contexts as well. But this definition of commission seems to address and narrow in a way that we'll probably be seeing some changes by providers in how they comply with this. So you probably have seen more of this than I have in some of the work you've been doing recently.
Yeah, in fact, I am working with people on making changes. A lot of the recognition awards, belonging to the President's Club or the Chairman Club or the Platinum Club or whatever you want to call it, and the different trips and bonuses and increased compensation are all being scrutinized for insurance products right now by the insurance companies themselves in terms of, what's the impact going to be and how much has to be eliminated and possibly if any of it can be kept, how can it be calculated. So that is a big change, and the insurance companies are looking at that very closely right now and recognizing that there will have to be some change. I agree with Brad, too, on the fixed index annuities. It just seems to me that the SEC hasn't classified them as securities, so the DOL would go out on a bit of a limb moving them over. Plus, as Brad pointed out, they hadn't proposed it. That would be a big change for something that had never been proposed. So, as Brad has caveated a number of times, we're just doing our best guess here. And my best guess is, as Brad's is, that is going to stay in 84-24, which the significance more than anything else, in my opinion, is that 84, from an advisor's perspective, is that 8424 is a lot easier to comply with than the best interest contract exemption would be. So for people who don't want to go to the extra effort of satisfying whatever the final BICE conditions are, they would probably then favor selling a fixed index annuity over an individual variable annuity to an IRA. On the other hand, if BICE becomes livable or tolerable, and if an advisor is willing to jump through the additional hoops, then it would be whichever the advisor thinks best fits the situation. Enough about 8424. Let's move to BICE. That's really where the action is, Brad. It's going to require a contract. It's up in the air as to when the contract has to be signed. Theoretically, it has to allow for class actions or dollar disclosures at point of sale annually and thereafter, and on and on and on, including some pressure to levelize advisor compensation at the broker-dealer level. With that very, very broad introduction, Brad, why don't you jump in and bring us up to date on where you think the major changes might be?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with trying to look at the BICE or the BIC exemption and see what might change and what needs to change is that, as you pointed out, there are just so many issues packed into this approach, many of which are almost equally significant. For example, for the individual variable annuities that now have to be, if an exemption is needed, they would have to go through that. What exemption would be needed to go through this? The BIC exemption as proposed just really wasn't written in a way that was conducive to insurance products, period. And I think some of the comments that the insurers in particular provided included, for example, certainly they would prefer that they be back in 8424, but also included an actual regulatory text suggestion, rewriting the BIC exemption to fit insurance products better. And one of the big questions there is, of all those changes that they recommended, which, if any, will DOL agree with and incorporate? And that's one of the big wild cards, of course, for all of this, but particularly for some of these insurance products in the BIC exemption. There's some real roadblocks that would have to be changed. You were saying, for example, about approaching levelization on compensation. One of the issues would be, will DOL agree to preserve sort of the more front-end commission-based structure that these types of products typically have? And the insurance industry noted that they may actually be cheaper over the life of the contract despite higher fees on the front end than, say, a standard 1% fee might be applied every year on an investment advisory account. So there's a lot of technical issues that we could go into there. Jump in.
Yeah, just one comment. I'm actually getting a fair number of questions from broker-dealer clients where, how do you determine how do you consider the compensation when you're comparing an individual variable annuity with maybe a mutual fund-based IRA? And for maybe you get 5% front-end load on the individual variable annuity and maybe a 1% finder's fee on the mutual funds, but then you get a smaller trailing commission on the annuity versus 25 or 50 basis points on the mutual fund, and on and on. And it does present significant issues, like how do you compare products that are structured to compensate in entirely different ways to each other in determining the reasonableness of the compensation, for example, which is another requirement. Comp has to be reasonable. And what we're looking at on that, and really all you can say is what the general rules are. It has to be, the compensation has to be reasonable relative to the services rendered. For example, how often is the advisor meeting with the mutual fund-based customer? How much time did it take to explain and sell the insurance product on the front end? So what are the ongoing services? What is the volume of services? What's the quality of services? And what's the proper measuring period? If you just look at the first year, well, that's not really the proper measuring period. Maybe it ought to be over 10 years because, as you said a second ago, Brad, I'm hearing, like you did, that viewed over a longer period of time, the annuity could be cheaper. So then the question becomes, what's the appropriate measuring period? And all of the advice I'm giving on that is just based on general principles. We don't there is no guidance on what the specific answers are. So it's becoming analytically difficult, challenging, but I think the approach that I just outlined is a proper approach for doing it. So I really think it's going to be the egregious cases that get in trouble, not people selling either kind of product with reasonable compensation and appropriately sold. And that's all. I just wanted to add that in, Brad, because it's already as an issue.
Yeah, and I would jump into that and say one of the key changes that probably needs to be made is that in considering what is reasonable compensation, that you take into account not just the services but also the product, you know, and the guarantees and so forth that are going to be quite different between a mutual fund and an annuity, for example. But you also said something there that, you know, you were saying you think it would be the egregious cases that would be ones that they would go after. I think this is where we segue into the liability question and the class action lawsuit question, which is it may well be true that the department would pursue an enforcement agenda that looks at egregious cases more so than, you know, finding footfalls on more routine cases. But that isn't necessarily true at all of what private litigation might result in. And one of the concerns that was expressed in a lot of the comments is that all of these conditions of the BIC exemption and the requirements of the contract, a lot of them are very fuzzy and require these judgment calls to justify differences between compensation practices. And as they teach you in law school, where there's two different interpretations, therein lies a lawsuit. So this class action piece, I don't see it coming out because for the department it really is the key manner of enforcement that they're putting in place for these exemptions. A way to hold people accountable really would be primarily, I think, through these private lawsuits. But it's also one of the more significant cost drivers, one of the more significant risk factors, and very hard to predict exactly how damaging this class action provision would be to the use and the utility of the BIC exemption. So that's going to be one of the big things to be looking for and see if DOL makes any changes either to the conditions or the litigation part that might make this more palatable. Go ahead.
I was going to say, speaking of lawsuits, Brad, what do you think? There's some threat that the private sector trade associations may file lawsuits against to have the regulation in one part or another set aside if it is issued in final form and becomes effective, as we suspect. What about that? What are you seeing in terms of not the litigation that could happen against service providers, but litigation by financial service trade associations against the regulation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously no one's going to decide whether they're going to litigate or not until they see the final rule and know what's in it. But if, you know, I think it would be safe to say that if the final rule were, you know, very similar to the proposal, that it's quite likely that there would be some questions raised and that some folks would go to, you know, the appropriate federal court and say, you know, there's at least two reasons why we think this rule it hasn't been done properly and we want you to stay its implementation until you hear these issues. You know, one would be the process by which the rule is made, looking for, you know, errors in that process or things that weren't properly considered under the Administrative Procedure Act, but also then the content of it, looking for things like this litigation, this class action litigation in state court. Is that something the department actually has the authority to do? And there's a number of questions about particularly the BIC exemption, where the department's establishing a fiduciary standard of care for an IRA advisor, where they're prohibiting binding arbitration and requiring class actions in state courts. Are those things the department actually could do in this regulation, since many of those they could not do directly, but can they do them as a condition of an exemption? So I think there's a lot of potential issues where litigation could come up about whether this rule was properly done. And we're going to have to wait and see what the final rule is before we can tell whether that litigation will occur and exactly what the concerns would be. But I think it's a very real thing the department is taking into account in its actions. I would assume that I'm going to be sued and be trying to structure my final rule as defensively as possible on that part. Whether they're doing that or not, I guess we'll see when it comes out.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I can't imagine they're not building a defense to the claim that they didn't properly investigate and analyze the issues. But I think, you know, the two other points you mentioned are intriguing intellectually. The fact that, you know, whether or not they can prohibit the financial services sector from not allowing class action lawsuits, and whether or not they can impose a fiduciary standard for IRAs through a contract where Congress did not impose one. Those, to me, are the two really, really interesting legal issues that could come out of this in terms of the litigation. But again, I think we would both agree, Brad, that to the extent we said it's hard to handicap legislation, it's even harder to handicap litigation. So
right.
I think we just have to throw those balls up in the air and see where they drop, don't you?
Yeah, I agree. But I'll say, you know, I read at the beginning some excerpts from this letter that the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee sent to the appropriators. It goes to a lot of evidence that might well be useful in some of these litigation questions. You know, if these internal documents show that other agencies with jurisdiction raised a bunch of valid points that DOL ignored, that's the kind of thing that goes to, well, was this an arbitrary and capricious rulemaking and so forth. So we will probably hear a lot more about this if the final rule looks a lot like the proposal.
Hey, you know, I read that letter too, Brad, and I was bothered by the fact that points were raised that were alleged to be ignored. And it seemed to me that, you know, that certainly information provided by the SEC should be listened to. But the point that I got hung up on, and I sort of just discounted it for politics, was that how could a congressman know that the DOL ignored it, as opposed to saying, that's very interesting information, but we actually think under the structure of ERISA, it would be better to do it differently. I mean, how can somebody prove that someone else ignored a comment? And I just said, well, they don't know that. They just wrote the letter saying that because that's politics. But I have to wonder if there's something they actually know to say it was ignored, or if what they're really trying to use the word ignored to mean that the Department of Labor disagreed, which I would think they would have some, they could appropriately disagree because their jurisdiction is ERISA, not the securities laws, and the ERISA statute is structured differently than the securities laws statutes. So I didn't know what to make of that part, of that word ignored. I just couldn't figure out how they would know if something was actually ignored.
I think that's a fair point. I think maybe there's a report coming that might provide some of those details. I mean, this is looking at a, you know, 2.5 page letter. So we'll see what comes out of it. I would say there must be some actual you know, meat there, because if nothing else, just look at the fact that the DOL proposal would require, as part of the BIC exemption, that you disclose, make reasonable assumptions about the future performance of investments as part of your fee disclosure, which is something the securities laws just don't allow. I mean, that's a pretty basic error, which you have to think someone like the SEC would have pointed out that DOL didn't seem to include.
And that could be cleaned up in the final exemption, right?
That certainly could be cleaned up, and I would suspect DOL would try to make sure it doesn't directly conflict with securities laws in a final rule. it's going to be interesting to see what other documents come out of this and what those say. There was one part in here that I thought was interesting where the Treasury Department was saying to DOL that it was that it wasn't properly interpreting congressional intent, and that might be I'm assuming that deals with IRAs, and that might be kind of an interesting bit of correspondence back and forth for all of us, including the courts, to take a look at.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I agree. I hope there is a report so we can get to the bottom of what they're saying. Hey, Brad, enough about this. What about, you know, there's been a number of pieces of guidance issued on solutions to the lack of coverage, MIRA, the DOL guidance on state plans or state-sponsored plans. Why don't you bring us up to speed with what's going on there?
Yeah, so there's been a broader narrative going on that, you know, it's great that our employee benefit system is, retirement system is providing benefits to, you know, millions of workers and has trillions of dollars in assets, but it's not covering everybody. And so there have been questions about how do we get more access to savings at retirement savings at work for folks in that, and the percentage that it is, you know, there's different numbers, but say somewhere between 20% and 40% of workers who don't have access to a workplace retirement plan. And the states have, several states in particular, California, Illinois, and then there's probably about 10 others that are pretty far down the road, are saying, well, we'd like to play in this space. We'd like to mandate payroll deduction IRAs or even go further and set up state-based exchanges that would, just as they do for healthcare, say if you want to buy a retirement plan, so to speak, come to our exchange where we're going to mandate certain conditions that they have to offer in order to be a retirement plan. And what's I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, certainly I understand that we need to be doing more to provide greater access to coverage. And, the federal government's looked at this in federal automatic IRA, payroll deduction IRA proposals in the past. But I'm very concerned that where DOL is going and the response DOL gave, which is a proposed regulation to say that ERISA wouldn't apply in cases where the states are mandating these payroll deduction IRAs, and also issued guidance that describes how ERISA would apply to some of these other scenarios. I'm just very concerned about the big public policy issues here that nobody has explored, that's just been a fast track on this regulation and guidance from one agency that deals with the big picture issue of ERISA preemption. What are the states going to do? What are the limits on what they do if this no longer is really a federal issue but starts becoming a joint federal-state issue? The states are going to be presumably deciding what the investments are that the things use, what the fees are. This raises questions about, we often see in state pension plans for their own employees that questions of politics get into how do they make investment decisions for those plans. There's just a lot of big issues here that I am concerned no one's had a chance to really explore, and that's going to be teed up by this fast-track regulation and guidance through the department. Doesn't necessarily mean things would be terrible if this went through, but I'm just worried that we haven't thought it through. And forging ahead with this is something that just concerns me as a matter of public policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, but thanks for the insights on that. Let me talk quickly about the DOL guidance on economically targeted investments, so-called ETIs. For those of you who are a little bit older, you may remember we had a round of these years ago, and they were called SRIs, socially responsible investments. Over the years, there have been a number of pieces of guidance from the DOL, and in fact, Brad was involved in one of them when he was at the department. But more recently, this year, just a matter of a month or two ago, the Department of Labor issued Interpretive Bulletin 2015-01, IB 2015-01. And essentially, it said there's two ways that you can have filters or screens for selecting what they call economically targeted investments. And the first is you can have a primary screen, which says we think that these factors will be significant in determining whether or not an investment is successful, a mutual fund, say. And then the other is a secondary screen, which is here's a list of 15 mutual funds, let's say large cap blend funds. And of these 15, they're all prudent. They can all be prudently selected. And one of the 15 has an ETI or SRI filter. But they're all prudent. Well, then, since you have 15 that are all prudent, that is, they all seem on an analysis of risk and return and similar issues, to be more or less the same, trying to look forward into the future, then you can, as a secondary condition, select among equal funds by weighing the ETI or SRI considerations. So you can have a primary filter or a secondary filter. Forgetting that filter concept, what this is really all about is saying, the Department of Labor trying to say, yes, as long as the investment is prudent, it's okay to invest in funds that have these other considerations. And I think underlying it is a desire to make plan sponsors feel more comfortable doing that. Based on a recent report that I read of the large institutional plans, which probably means billion-dollar plans plus, maybe 15 to 20% of the defined contribution plans of that size have at least one investment that has an ETI or an SRI filter as a part of it. So it's not uncommon. It's certainly not the predominant practice, but it's not an uncommon practice either. Brad, I think you have a little perspective on this because you had to actually work with it. Why don't you bring us up to speed on your view?
Yeah, so let me first off explain my bias here before I make my comments. We put out, while I was at the administration, the prior administration, we put out Interpretive Bulletin 2008-01, which took only the latter view. It said that when you're making decisions for a plan about investments, you have to make them based on the economic factors and not on these other considerations. You can't subordinate the interests of the participants to any of these other objectives, you know, whether it's social good or green investing or anti-gun investing or Sharia law compliant investing, whatever your issues there are, you got to do the economics first because this is about making workers have solid retirements. So what we said is, therefore, if you get to a tiebreaker, that scenario Fred was describing where you've got economically equivalent investments and now you've got to pick among them, that's when you could consider something like these ETI factors to break the tie, and you should document that decision. What the department has done here is say, really, you can now put those ETI considerations as factors of assessing the prudence of the investment in the first place. So it's no longer a tiebreaker between economically equivalent investments, but rather one of the factors you use to determine whether an investment is prudent. And I think that's personally, I think that's a little bit troubling. But, you know, again, that's why I revealed my bias to start out with. I worry about pension funds being used in connection with political not political campaigns in the sense of running for office, but, you know, political campaigns in the sense of issue advocacy. And I think the prior executive or interpretive bulletin did a better job of keeping pension funds out of those political games, and I'm worried that that this extension, this change, the revision in the current interpretive bulletin will make that a little easier. I think that's different in kind than what Fred was talking about, where where you're seeing a variety of plans offering, say, an investment option on a plan menu that might have some of these features. You know, I'll note also in that same report that when it came to defined benefit plans, that there was very little use of ETIs in their investments. And I think, again, that goes to the question of putting the interest, the economic interest of the participants first. So I'll just say all that. It, you know, my opinion no longer matters in the sense of what the DOL puts out, so that's up to them. But I think putting a thumb on the scale in favor of social justice or whatever objectives you want to say, to me is a worrisome trend to go, a worrisome path to start down. There, I'll get back off my soapbox again.
Nice job, Brad. I worry about it a little bit, too. I mean, I like the concept of, and I think it might appeal to young participants, millennials, and participant-directed plans. For example, a balanced fund that has ETI considerations. But I worry about the misuse that Brad worries about as well. So I think that's our point, and let's move on. I'm going to talk very quickly about a couple cases because I really only want to leave you with one message on each one. First is recently there was a lawsuit filed against Intel, and people may see that as a lawsuit regarding hedge funds, or they may see it as a lawsuit regarding custom target date portfolios. I don't really think it's necessarily either of those. I think it's a lawsuit involving process. And essentially, you know, cutting through the weeds, Intel had target date funds that were custom funds, and they allocated a very large proportion or a percentage of the assets in those funds to hedge funds, much larger than the norm. This may be more a case about do you deviate from the norm than anything else. And the first issue is it okay to have hedge funds in a plan or in a portfolio? And I think the obvious answer to that is, yeah, sure. You know, modern portfolio theory is the fundamental foundation of ERISA's investment principles. And as a part of that, if you have different asset classes that are not highly correlated, you can have almost any investment you want as long as it fits into the portfolio. So the second question then is, were those particular hedge funds prudently selected? Well, you know, I would guess that seeing as this is a large major corporation with a lot of sophisticated people working there, you would assume they engaged in a prudent process regarding the expenses and the management, you know, the quality and the quantity issues. So again, I can't say that as affirmatively as I could say there's no prohibition on the use of hedge funds. But It would surprise me a little bit if they hadn't engaged in a pretty good process. And then the third is, was the allocation proper or was the allocation prudent? Now, the thing that makes it stand out is that it was a much higher allocation to hedge funds than what you normally see. So it tells you there's a chance if you're doing things out of the norm that you might get questioned. It doesn't say, though, that you're going to be liable. It just says you might get questioned. And obviously a complaint's a pretty big question. But, you know, I'm no investment expert, so I can't say if it was prudent or not in my estimation. But I will point out, for those of you who follow John Reckenthaler at Morningstar, that John wrote an article called Three Lessons from Yale's Endowment Fund. And he points out that the Intel investment approach was very similar to the investment approach of Yale's Foundation Fund, where they allocate very large percentages of assets to hedge funds. If you're interested in knowing more about this, it's an article that John Reckenthaler wrote for Morningstar called Three Lessons from Yale's Endowment Fund, dated November 20th. So go read that, because I'm not an investment guy and I can't go beyond what I just said. In any event, I'm worried that you might be reading articles that are misinterpreting that case. And I really think it is about the three issues. One, can hedge funds be properly selected? Yes. Two, were these prudently selected? I suspect so, but I don't know. Three, was the allocation appropriate or prudent? And I suggest you read John's article on that, because that's an investment issue. Having said that, let me jump over to the Tibble decision, or really
if
a three
decision. If I can just throw in one quick thing, I would also make sure people don't misinterpret this. This is not saying that custom target date funds or custom target date model portfolios present any problems. In fact, those are becoming increasingly popular among large plans and others because they allow you to, you know, more closely track some of the factors that you have to determine in assessing the prudence. I agree with Fred. I think this is about the process of how that particular set of investments were selected, particularly when they were outside of some of the what we normally see, and not a broader indictment of custom target date funds or model portfolios.
Absolutely. Thanks for hitting that, Brad. I think that's a critical point. Moving over to the Tibble case, which is actually three cases, the trial court decision, the Court of Appeals decision, and the Supreme Court decision. The real lesson to get out of that is that you have to be selecting a share class that's appropriate for the plan of that of your size. I mean, within in those cases, it was retail versus institutional. In other cases, it may be R1 versus R5. But whatever it is you need to know, you need to be recommending as an advisor the appropriate share class. As a plan sponsor, you need to be selecting the appropriate share class. So it's not just about the average expense ratio of mutual funds. It's not about that plus do you have the right share class, and is the expense ratio reasonable relative to that share class. We have, in recent months, had two DOL investigations where the Department of Labor has asked for information justifying the share classes held by the plans. In one of those cases, the investment advisor, an RIA to the plan, a year ago, 2 years ago now, had actually sat down with the committee and gone through each share class they have and why they have that share class, and the committee approved of that report and of the share classes. As you might imagine, that evidence was just incredibly valuable, and we disposed of that investigation almost immediately because of that. I encourage every plan committee and every advisor to have a meeting this year or next year in the next 12 months so that you go through the share classes of each of the investments in the plan, why that share class is there, what the expense ratios are, what the revenue sharing is, where the revenue sharing goes, and so on. Because that's what a share class is. It's really a combination of those different factors. Now, that continues the drumbeat on plan expenses and on investment expenses. That's just this constant drumbeat of litigation and DOL comments. To make matters even more complicated, recently Boeing settled a large lawsuit for a staggering amount of money, $50 or $60 million, about their 401k plan. There, the allegation by the plaintiff's attorneys was not about institutional versus retail, but instead was they were so big that they should have had separately managed accounts rather than any mutual funds at all. And that came down to a very large settlement. I mean, generally speaking, the settlements that we see that might be viewed as risk of litigation settlements, you know, just that we don't think you got a claim, but we're just going to settle, might be $5, $10, $15 million. But certainly when you get well above that, then it suggests more than just an everyday risk. It could still be a risk of litigation settlement, but there's a little more meat on the bone there. So I encourage you to really be looking at the investment expenses. Not that you have to have the lowest, but that for a plan of that size and with those characteristics, you have to have the appropriate one. Having said that, we've got just a few minutes to open up for questions. Operator, do you want to ask for a few questions?
Yes, sir. And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, please press star 1 at this time if you'd like to ask a question. And once again,
well, while we're waiting for the first question, I would just point out, I just read a report that we were talking about that Senate committee and its letter talking about the documents. Apparently, they are going to be issuing a full report in the not-too-distant future, so we'll be seeing a lot more about that.
Great. Well, then we can talk about that on our next call.
There you go.
We do have a question on the phone.
Hi. This is Rebecca Moore with Plan Sponsor Magazine. I have a question about the ETIs. Do you foresee that, I know you said that you were worried about, using this as some kind of political or advocacy tactic. Do you foresee plans getting in trouble as far as fiduciary responsibility? Do you see more like regulatory enforcement or litigation coming up because of this?
Fred, I think that's more.
Yeah, I don't know that I would necessarily be able to say at this point whether we're going to see litigation resulting from this. It does certainly make the department's position on enforcement much more accommodating and broad and accepting of this conduct than it would have been based on the previous guidance. And to me, that's sort of source of concern. You know, while in the Bush administration, while I was at the agency, we had a couple of occasions where, and I won't be too specific, but where some unions tried to see if they could somehow use pension funds in relation to efforts about Social Security reform and some other big picture issues, which, the department explained that that would not be a wise thing to do. And that's the kind of thing that I'm concerned where this could head. I mean, basically what they've done is say, instead of this being a tiebreaker, you can now consider these as relevant factors in determining the prudence of an investment itself. And I personally think that's potentially a bridge too far, and it opens a door for analyzing factors that don't necessarily go just to the benefit of the participant. Now, to be fair to the department, they did reiterate that you still cannot subordinate the interests of the participants. This still has to be a fiduciary analysis. Those factors, while they may now be relevant factors to consider in the upfront decision, still have to be weighed against other considerations. So it wasn't, I don't want to portray it as open season on do whatever you want for whatever political reasons. My concern is that it's a question of tone and suggesting where the department's enforcement priorities would be. And it's definitely a change to the more permissive side. And I think that that's not necessarily advisable. But I think I'll be more blunt. It's not advisable in my view.
Operator, if there's one more question, we have time for one more.
And there are no further questions in the queue.
Oh, okay. Well, everybody, that brings the formal part of the presentation to a close. Why don't we talk about what's coming up next? And Bill, why don't you jump in on that?
Great, thank you. I'll just remind everybody that a recording of this call will be available sometime early next week, and you'll receive a notification from Natixis on that. And if everybody would like to note their calendars for the next quarterly call, it will take place on Thursday, March 10th, 2016. And again, that will be our 15th call with Drinker Biddle. And on behalf of Drinker Biddle and Natixis, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you all very much.
And Jay will close. Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.